Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. My guests today are Diane Coyle, the new Bennett Professor of Public Policy at the University of Cambridge. She's also an ONS Fellow on Measurement Issues in the Modern Economy and the author of several books, including GDP, A Brief but Affectionate History. And my second guest is Paul Swinney, Head of Policy and Research at the Centre for Cities. And we're going to be talking about measuring the economic performance of the UK economy and in particular its cities, what some of the challenges and the opportunities are of that. So Diane, starting with you, you've written a lot about GDP and the goods and the bads of GDP. Just give us a sense as to where we are with GDP, not least, you know, you hear this a lot in the press particularly, you know, this gasp that GDP isn't equivalent to measurements of economic welfare or well-being, which is well known to people like you, but less well known to many others. So give us a sense as to where we are with GDP and how useful it is in its current context.
Well, in the public debate, of course, GDP growth, is it 0.4 or 0.3% this quarter, is the number that we all look at.
Yeah.
And in that sense, it's definitely used as a measure of how well the economy is getting on.
Yeah.
But there have always been some problems about it that economists and statisticians know very well, but others might not have realised. One obvious one is not taking account of environmental factors. Another one is that all the work that people do at home, especially women, has not been counted as part of the economy, so it's not been measured either. So that's kind of long-standing. But that's been joined by another set of issues to do with digital technology and how that's changing how we can interpret the figures. Some of this it might be to do with prices. If you buy a computer now, you'll pay the same price that you would have 2 years ago, but the spec of the computer is much better. You're getting much better quality. So if we want to divide GDP in the bit that's due to general inflation and the bit that's real, then we want to take account of that quality change somehow. And that applies to all kinds of goods. But there are other factors. So I mentioned that already that GDP doesn't take account of work done in the home. Mm. Digital technology is changing that because some of the things that we used to buy in the market we're now doing for ourselves at home.
Yeah.
Things like online banking or travel agency, things like the sharing economy where you're using an asset you have at home like a spare room to make some income. And things like creating open source software or Wikipedia entries or putting educational material or entertaining stuff online, all of those free goods. So that boundary is blurring and none of that is being counted in GDP. And then finally, there are changes in the way people do business that mean it's really hard to interpret the figures that we see published. One example is cloud computing. Mm. Companies used to invest in their own computer servers, spent a lot of money on the kit, developed their own software, and those things added to GDP. What they do now, even very large companies, is pay Amazon Web Services, and that gets counted as an ongoing cost of doing business, and that's taken off GDP. So they're getting a better service for less money, and somehow that's reducing the economy. So my research is all about looking at this range of things and trying to figure out which are the big ones, which are the small ones, what direction do they go in, and what does that mean for the published statistics and how we should interpret
them. Yeah, and your point, I think, if I remember rightly from the book particularly, but from other writings, is that you know, the wedge between what GDP currently measures and what we would class as the modern economy is growing over time because of some of the changes that you've suggested, as well as other issues becoming much more prominent, environmental concerns, as you know, are more prominent today than they were, a decade or a generation ago. And interestingly, I think issues around inequality, so distributional issues, GDP's not so good on in terms of how we think about that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And also not just distribution between different groups in the income ladder, but geographic distribution as well, which we might want to get onto later.
Yeah, exactly. And you, interestingly, in the your Indigo submission, which you won joint first prize for, you talk about how we might address some of the shortfalls of GDP in the short run, as well as move into a slightly different way a fundamentally different way of measuring or thinking about the economy in the long run. Just give us a sense as to what amends we could do in the short run.
to make the GDP slightly better than it currently is?
There are some reasonably straightforward fixes we could do to get a better indicator. One would be measuring better in what's called intangibles or intellectual property, where a lot of the value that's created in the economy doesn't have any material shape, and that's not, we've not been great at measuring that, so we can do a bit better on that. Another would be looking at distribution. We always just have the headline GDP growth number. Why don't we look at it in per capita terms, and why don't we look at the income distribution? And we've got the figures to be able to do that. So those are pretty straightforward. Another one we suggested was the finance sector, actually.
Yeah.
The way we measure it now, the biggest contribution to GDP growth ever from the finance sector came in the final quarter of 2008. Mm-hmm. So there's something wrong with the way we're doing that, because it wasn't going very well then. So we suggest reverting to how we used to do it before.
Yeah.
So those are quite straightforward to do, and that would give us a better handle. And then we can think as we do that, think about long-term fixes. If we want to measure how well the economy is progressing in some fundamental sense, what would we switch to?
Yeah, and those three propositions, those three ideas, they're all doable in a sense. You know, they don't require quite fundamental, you know, reworking or rethinking. Is that right?
They're doable and they're halfway done already. This is work that the Office of National Statistics has already got in hand, and there's been research on all of these areas.
Yeah. Paul, if we think about cities, or Centre for Cities thinks about cities, but GDP and, you know, we sometimes think about it in a national context as well, don't we?
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting, the conversation about the role of GDP. I think it's particularly in our area when I think economists tend to get sort of painted as these heartless beings that, you only care about where the money is, and it's all GDP and nothing else. And I think we get pulled into this straw man element of saying, well, actually, you just don't care, when the reality is economics looks at trying to maximise welfare, however that may well be defined, rather than the narrow definition of GDP. I think what is interesting within this debate, which Diane actually sets out very differently, which is great, it's great to hear, and obviously sort of reading her stuff from the past, is that sometimes it feels like the people who set up the arguments about economists being heartless sort of use GDP as a dirty sort of thing of trying to measure the economy is not what we want to do, and instead we're going to measure something else. So instead we'll measure happiness in place of GDP, or we'll measure some of the other things we talk about communities, for example, we'll measure community spirit. Now, I think all of that is important, and I think what we're talking about here is trying to extend our measurement of the economy to include those elements, whereas sometimes the debate seems to get pulled in the way that actually we just shouldn't really measure the economy, and really all that's important is distribution issues, or all that is important is community factors. And I think, you know, having this conversation about actually what is it that we are trying to measure, and how do we refine what we've got, how do we change what we've got, how do we improve what we're using currently, I think is where we want to be pushing this debate.
Dan, what were your reflections? I mean, what's your reflection on why GDP is often used to inappropriately to think about economic welfare issues? I mean, where does that come from? It's not economists, I would argue, don't refer to it in that way. Is it that the media have just got it into their heads that that's what, you know, that's how they're going to talk about it?
Well, I wouldn't exonerate economists.
Very good.
Though I am one. The origins are kind of political, really. Nobody started trying to measure the national economy until we had the Great Depression and the Second World War, so that was the first imperative. And then focusing on growth came with the Cold War. And there's a famous speech by the Soviet leader Khrushchev saying that he would defeat Americans on the hammer of industrial growth, and so Kennedy wrote growth targets in GDP growth targets into the new Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the Rich Countries Club. So that was where that came from. And obviously attention does focus on different statistics at different times, including, you know, it's been the balance payments at some times, it was the unemployment rate during the 1980s, so different figures do come to the fore. But what's kind of worrying about using GDP is when you look into it and understand how much judgment goes into it, the way it's being used for things like, you know, debt rescue packages or Maastricht criteria for government borrowing, those kinds of what we would call administrative uses are concerning, because it's not a thing, it's not a natural object, it's an analytical construct that you make lots of judgments about.
And that's quite interesting as well. I think it was only, you know, having studied economics for a number of years, it was only recently reading about how GDP is put together was actually the first time I'd encountered some of these challenges, and that came as a bit of a surprise. You know, there was no discussion of that, remember, all those years ago at university, or how we put this together. It was just, we use GDP, and GDP is a good thing, and this is how we measure it and look out for the changes quarter on quarter.
Well,
and
I'm old, so we were taught a little bit about it, but it has dropped out of the curriculum.
Yes, dropped out, and I was actually quite shocked to find out how all the different challenges, and dead fascinated by it, but actually all the different challenges that are faced by trying to measure this. And I think it is difficult. I think we have to say that. You know, this is not a case of well, this has been measured incorrectly, and it's, and if only just change like this, it would be very easy to do. But it is quite surprising, actually, the number of assumptions and approximations that go into sort of creating GDP, and indeed, you know, intangible assets, as you touched on there, being the big issue at the moment, or how you try to capture some of that.
Sorry to interrupt. It's become really interesting to a lot of people at the moment. So I'm astounded by how much general interest there is, number of books for the general audience being published, literary festivals want to have talks about it. So there is a moment here when people realise that something is probably changing.
I think you're right. Notwithstanding, you know, people's understanding of GDP, the interest in the economy and the measurement of the economy and what that really feels like on the ground, particularly when people see numbers that increasingly don't correspond to their own life experiences or indeed the community in which they live, I think is a really interesting one. I was going to pick up on one of your suggested amends, because it touches on a previous podcast we did with Stian Westlake and Jonathan Haskell, who were talking about their book about, you know, the rise of intangible capital as part of the modern economy. And I think, you know, interestingly, we got into a conversation where, you know, a lot of that intangible stuff is urban in many respects, and, you know, both in terms of where it happens and the factors. Roll in some of that stuff into GDP, then what sort of effect would it have on GDP in terms of the numbers we might see, or the way that we would think about it? Would we think, would the numbers be ordinary, you know, significantly different?
You mean if the things that I was talking about get fixed? I don't know how it would wash out. My hunch is that we would have more GDP than we think at the moment, but that we probably have less fundamental economic welfare than we think.
And that is
because I would rather think about economic welfare in a completely different way. The trouble with GDP is it's all about income and consumption this year. And if you want to take account of the future and sustainability, you need to somehow to get the future into the numbers, not just this year. And there's also this sense about what is it that creates people's well-being. And in economics, it's always, we call it utility, but it's, you know, what are you doing that gives you benefit at the moment? And I prefer the theory that says, what do you have access to? What assets do you have access to that allow you to lead the life that you want to? And this is Amartya Sen's capabilities theory, it's called. And that takes you in a completely different set of measures, but also one that's actually much more about literally access and geography, which is obviously relevant to the cities and the kind of work that you're doing here.
Yeah. We'll get on to that. What's your thought on Tyler Cowen's idea that essentially we should treat the future in exactly the same way as we treat the present? In a sense, he wouldn't discount the future when making decisions, particularly around economic growth. He argues for a much bringing the future right into the present, which would affect the way that the kind of decisions that we would make, and would make us much more considerate of things like the environment and the impacts on the environment. Do you think there's... Are you in agreement with that?
I don't think we should discount the way we do now. I wouldn't go to as far as saying we should treat it exactly the same. I would follow people's moral intuition, which is that you would care about, certainly about your children, your grandchildren, and you work back how you want to discount things from that moral intuition.
Yeah, okay. Let's move on to... So let's, as a segue into the sort of subnational conversation, because I think it's relevant... As I said in the introduction, you've been thinking about moving beyond GDP as a way to think about and measure the economy into a basket of indicators, like a dashboard type approach. Can you just say a little bit more about your thinking around that? And then I think that connects into often the way that we think about cities and actually some of the measures that we use, you know, when we're looking at their performance.
Well, mine isn't just any old dashboard. There are loads of dashboards around. And
that's good.
There are too many.
There are too many.
241 sustainable development goals, 50 things on the ONS Wheel of Wellbeing, social progress, there's millions of them.
All of them equally important.
And there are all kinds of good things that you would be interested in for certain purposes.
Yeah.
And I want to have something that's much more parsimonious, because otherwise you can't have that public conversation about it.
Yeah.
And part of the purpose of official statistics is so that voters and politicians can have that that debate
and you
can hold them to account.
Yeah.
So I would like quite a small dashboard, and I would like one that's somehow rooted in economic theory. And I think about it in terms of these six kinds of capital. So one is intangible, which we talked about, but human capital, physical and infrastructure capital, natural capital, social capital, and financial, net financial capital. So it gives you quite a wide waterfront boiled down to these six assets. But the tricky bit, I think, is what you want to get out of this is, can people do what they want to with their life?
Yeah.
So you need to know the mapping. And one of the features about disadvantaged communities is that they've got lousy natural capital because the air's really polluted and they've got no parks. The infrastructure is terrible. There's no bus route into town or no train into town, so they can't get the jobs. Mm. The social capital has frayed because of all the social problems that exist in that kind of community. So you get this sort of amplification. But you need to understand the geographical distribution of it.
Yeah.
And that's quite hard to do.
Yeah.
Paul? As you know.
Yes, definitely. Well, this is the element that we talk about. We talk about sort of the mismeasurement of the economy at the national level and that being an issue, and then you sort of get into the city stuff and think, well, we don't even really measure the economy at all in a same sort of consistent way at the local level. So it's not even an element of, we're not even at GDP for cities, are we, at the moment? We are sort of then talking about trying to repackage how we frame at the national level. It makes you think even more how far, even further we are at the local level trying to capture some of this stuff. But as we know, and as we continue to show in our work, now there's huge variation across the country. And I think even with the data we do have, we see that there's that clearly, you know, what's going on in Burnley is very different, or the performance of the economy in Burnley is very different to what is the case in Bristol or is in the case in Reading. And I think trying to capture that is really important. I think it opens up a much greater understanding of what's going on across the country, rather than just, you know, the growth was 0.4% this quarter, which is presented at a national level, but clearly plays out differently in different places. But as you say, it's really difficult. You know, if this is difficult to do at the national level, actually trying to pin down where activity occurs within different parts of the country, given how companies transfer elements and of their activities and things like that, is hard to pin down.
But in, you know, like the old joke says, you wouldn't start from here. You know, we've given the statistics that we've got now, it's going to be hard to build on those to get to what we want to get to.
Yes.
So I think we need to talk about some new approaches to it.
Mm, yeah. So I mean, we'll definitely come on to that. But Paul, just set out for a minute, you know, when Centre for Cities is looking at city economies and trying to get a grip on their performance, how are we thinking about that, and what data are we using, or what frameworks are we using to organise the thinking around that?
Mm. It's really interesting, I think, the data that's available at a local level. Certainly we're seeing quite big improvements, I think, over the last 10 years in particular in terms of data that's available. But I think there are a couple of issues with it. So first off, you know, trying to measure the size of the economy in the traditional sense is fairly difficult. We have gross value added, which is like gross domestic product, but not quite the same. But we can take that and divide that by jobs and get a measurement of productivity. And we're all interested in productivity at the moment, so that's quite interesting to do. However, what, you know, productivity or trying to measure GV at the local level is tough. You know, issues do come up within the data. So it means that actually you are guided by what it says, but you always have to try and consult other data as well to get a broader picture in terms of what's going on. And I think we see this if we look at some of the data sets that are based on surveys, surveys on jobs to some extent, certainly surveys on wages, where the sample size tends to be very small when you get down to a place the size of Cambridge or Burnley or something like that, where one indicator sometimes can throw a bit of a funny result And it does mean that actually consulting a number of indicators then becomes, I think, even more important when looking at local economies, because just taking that one readout from that one survey doesn't necessarily capture what's going on. And by getting that or looking across that basket can allow you to probably identify when that starts to happen and think, well, that's a little bit inconsistent, that doesn't feel right. Okay, what does that mean in terms of how we treat this data?
Yeah, and you said, so, you know, Centre for Cities looks at, you know, data in, going back to what you were saying about the basket, it looks at data in relation to human capital, skills, qualifications, you know, performance and those sorts of things. Does look at data in relation to business and enterprise, closure, starts, innovation, patents, you know, not perfect, and a range of other things. So just say a little bit about that and then get Diane to kind of reflect on that, how that might fit with your thinking at the, I guess, at the national level of the economy.
I think it's, you know, what's always interesting when you see baskets of indicators is that they tend to, obviously this is a bit of a sweeping statement, but they tend to not really give any weight to a number of, sort of to different indicators within there, or if the weights are there, they're sort of quite arbitrary. And again, it's quite difficult to apply that. But I think actually trying to think through some of the, or think through what we're looking at and understand what those indicators are showing actually is really, really important in terms of our understanding of local economies. So I think there's an element of inputs within what we look at. So as you say, stock of human capital, very, very important in terms of what we look at. We tend to see that those places that have higher stocks of human capital tend to have higher productivity, as opposed to, say, things like wages, which is more of an output. And it's about splitting those things out, trying to understand what is this show? Is that an input into trying to understand why places perform the way they do or not? Or is it an outcome, a measure of that relative performance? And then there's probably another element within there too. And you know, our one that we're always discussing in the office is about inequality. And the measure that we've been put together for inequality, a Gini coefficient at the local level, shows that places like London and Cambridge come out as being very unequal, whereas looking at places like Burnley or Mansfield actually come out as being very equal. Now, the interesting thing about that is, think, well, what does that then mean? Because we do know that places like Mansfield and Burnley have big economic challenges and certainly don't perform as well as say, what London and Cambridge do. And actually, when you then put this together with some of the other indicators and have this sort of broader view of what's going on, what it seems to suggest is that there's, to some degree, that this is a representation of opportunity or economic opportunity available in different places, and that actually in Cambridge there are lots of high-paid jobs, which then by definition means that the place gets more unequal, whereas there's much less of that opportunity in a place like Burnley. So actually this measure of inequality where Burnley comes out as being more equal actually isn't necessarily a good thing. And I don't think we'd be necessarily proposing that a place like Reading or Cambridge becomes more like Burnley, because clearly it has bigger challenges than what those more southern cities have.
Danny, go on. Your reflection on that. But I mean, you were part of the Industrial Strategy Commission.
Yeah.
You know, there was a chunk of pages given over to the state of a subnational measurement data metrics, etc. That you clearly felt was something that had a detrimental effect on how we think about policy making in the country, and particularly at the subnational level. But just your thoughts on that. And
it was a kind of two-pronged thought. It's obviously fabulous to have great cities like London and Cambridge or the M4 corridor growing so fast and being so high value and productive. But if we want to raise average national productivity, then we're going to have to do it by raising the productivity of other cities as well.
Yeah.
And the economy does happen in cities. There's one economist once called them a boom in space rather than in time. Mm. You know, economic activity is clustered. So there's a second question, because that clustering does seem to be getting more powerful, that effect, about what to do about the places that are not the cities, which look even more hopeless if you put a pessimistic perspective on it. So our argument there was that all places need to have a minimum infrastructure guarantee. So that if you are in a place like Burnley, it's going to be fabulous if it can build out from whatever skills or advantages it does have and grow that over time, but that's going to be slow. So at the same time, you need to make sure the people living there have access to the broadband, the transport, the schools and hospitals, that if, you know, give them the human capital, and then they can do without what they want. Mm. They can stay or they can go and work somewhere else.
And, you know, your reflection, both through the Commission's work, but more generally, get Paul to come in as well, on why we have this, you know, why we have the degree and quality of subnational statistics that we do. in a sense. You know, we measure what matters, and what matters we measure. Is there something in there in the sense that we haven't, you know, we haven't thought enough about or focused enough about subnational issues, which is in part a reflection and is reflected in the fact that we have, you know, we don't have great data on it. Is that fair or not?
I think we don't have great data because we've been such a centralised polity for such a very long time, and nobody's thought the data is important. And even at the height of the Victorian era, when our great industrial cities were the most exciting places to be in the world, you know, Liverpool or Glasgow at that time, that wasn't part of the national perspective. And given how we collect the data through this top-down approach, and it's still largely based on paper surveys that are sent to people they've always been sent to, it's quite hard to shift that perspective. And we're not going to get the really good subnational data using those traditional methods, I don't think. You know, it's going to be too costly to do it that same way. So thinking about new techniques, new data techniques, will be part of the way that we get the visibility about all these subnational economies.
I get your thought, Paul, you come in on that.
I was going to say, and it's, and exactly that as well, I think, and there's an element of frustration around this too, is that we've actually collected a lot of this data for a number of years through administrative tax data. You know, it sits up there as a byproduct of trying to sort of run the state or run civil society. And I think that's, when you look at the subnational picture, it's very frustrating that we just haven't made use of that huge asset. I mean, it's interesting, we're talking about assets in the context of measuring the economy. Actually, you know, the public sector has sat on huge assets in terms of knowledge, in that the data that they've collected for a long time and yet just not used.
And ONS is starting to use that. I mean, it's big data, they're going to start using it.
And so that's fantastic. I think that ONS definitely have started to change over recent years their perspective. And I think the Bain Review's probably pushed a little bit of that, but I think that we're going in some departments going that direction already. And it's very exciting that I think they can start to
But it goes back to the political point, I think, which is that when the politics of city devolution became important, the data became important.
Yeah, precisely. And I think there's, you know, there's a wider issue, I think, within the way economics is taught more generally, particularly with the exception of only a couple of courses in the UK at the moment, in that what is taught is macro, which means countries, and what is sort of the size of the British economy look like, the French one or the US one, or we get micro, which is businesses. There's never ever really any understanding about, well, those businesses cluster in very specific places within those countries, and that has implications in terms of how the national economy performs. And so what that means is, I think you then produce economists, some of which may say go into civil service, or historically have gone into civil service with this mindset of, well, we govern the national economy and we're making policy for that, or perhaps economists in the Bank of England who go off in the same, their mindset or the way they've been trained is that it is flat earth, it is one economy, one country, and we, you know, we just do statistics on that.
Yeah. And lots of graduates doing professional jobs go to work in London or have done. You know, it's only quite recently that Manchester University's had retained more than half its graduates in Manchester.
Exactly. And I think that's the, things are starting to change now, but that also contributes to this idea, I think, of not having historically fantastic local statistics, which, let's say, feels like things are starting to change. And better use of administrative data will really push on, I think, our understanding of how different places perform, which will then mean that we have a much better understanding of how the national economy functions, which is obviously something that we're all interested in.
The word statistic comes from the word state, and they are the numbers that the state needs to do its job. And if the state isn't bothered about anything apart from the national level, then you don't have the statistics for it.
Paul, you talked a little bit about HMRC data, which is very, you know, always talked about in terms of giving us a real additional and in-depth perspective, which is almost population, you know, full population. Are there other existing data sets or existing, you know, areas that we know we could mine a bit more, and then get then reflect on, you know, new techniques or, you know, new approaches to getting some of that? I mean, are there, because there's stuff around land. I mean, land is always a question, I think, about who owns the land, land ownership. There is some of that data out there, but it's not organised or coordinated in any way, is it?
Indeed, it's very piecemeal, I think, in terms of the stuff that's available, especially when it comes to who owns commercial property. That is very difficult to try and get an understanding of. And you see bits and pieces here and there, but that sort of thing then starts to become very important at the local level when When you're, say, you've got an issue with your city centre, very fragmented ownership, you don't really know who's in charge, you might well have a lot of shop fronts which are quite dilapidated, but who do you go and pull up about that? You know, and that has a very real policy impact. I think there's other data that exists, say around vacancy data that local authorities do collect, vacant properties that is, and there has been, I know of work by someone we've been speaking to recently at a company called Piaka, I think is how it's pronounced. Apologies, Gavin, if you're listening, I've got that wrong. Where he's been speaking to the Information Commission about trying to get this vacancy data released, and actually he's come up with a lot of resistance from particular local authorities who have been saying, well, actually, we can't release this data because people will break in and steal copper pipes, or we can't release this data because it might sort of be used in sort of terrorist-type activities, which seems very sort of odd, I think, some of the arguments that have been put forward. And so there's this element too, I think, even from the local level, particularly from the public sector, which is not wanting to release this data because apparently it's going to be used for ill means, when actually I think releasing some of this data really would help us understand what's going on. So yes, HMRC is an element of that. Local authorities also sit on a lot of data which isn't sort of released currently and has shown some resistance to it. And no doubt there are other sort of data lurking somewhere in the archives that we're not even aware of at the moment, but actually would really help both allow us to understand the economy better, but then ultimately improve policy as a result of that.
There's a lot of private data too, and I think tapping into that is going to be essential. You know, ONS is never going to be funded to do all the things that we would all like it to do. Mm. So somehow we're going to have to find a way of tapping into the private data, and particularly for new machine learning techniques or big data techniques. Satellite data is one area that economists are looking at the moment. Quite a lot of work has been done on looking at poverty measures or income measures in developing countries. Mm. But I think that's got a lot of potential for looking at the economy, particularly the geography of it. But there are private companies collecting wage data, collecting prices on all kinds of websites that are selling things. So we could, if we can find the technical standards, the interoperability and the protocols for pooling all of that, that would be a fantastic national resource to have. But I think we're only just embarking on that journey. You know, given it's only recently HMRC has agreed that its data can be used for these purposes.
Yes.
We've got a long way to go before we get to this nirvana of publicly available, a public good of available data.
And are you optimistic that we will get there, Diane, in terms of, you know, in terms of that public, well, public to a degree, but the private elements, which is always mobile phone usage and coverage and, you know, and all of these sorts of things?
Yeah, well, it's quite tricky because companies actually don't often themselves know what they've got.
Yeah.
They've got other legal requirements, you know, they've got privacy concerns, they've got it in different formats and it's, you know, on different kinds of machines, so it's not interoperable. So there's quite a lot of hurdles to overcome. The conversation's starting, and I think there's a great prize there because the commercial potential that you open up for new businesses or innovation through making that available would be quite large. And, you know, that would be a great path for UK policy to go down. If we can start this conversation and start setting the standards and the protocols, I think that would be really, really promising.
Yeah. And you both touched on it in slightly different ways, but I get both your reflections on, in a sense, on the one hand, the policy development and the policy agenda as it relates to cities and devolution has clearly had a galvanizing effect on the requirements for data and better measurement over and above what, you know, people who are interested in data and measurement will do off their own back. You know, there's a policy pressure that has been useful in sort of moving this agenda forward. And I just wonder, you know, whether you agree with that and actually, you know, how that speaks to the importance of maintaining the policy agenda in relation to cities or to, you know, devolution, which in part will then produce better data. I don't know whether you would agree with that, Diane, or whether you would...
Yeah, this is an area that I've been working on for many years. Mm. And, you know, it's anybody who's been involved in the city devolution agenda will tell you it's taken, 20 or 25 years to get where we got to now. Yeah. So one doesn't want to get over-optimistic. But I think there are two things that will keep the momentum up. One is the politics of the way people have been voting in the UK and, you know, the recent elections, Brexit vote and election, there's been a clear geography to that. That's not going to change. Mm-hmm. And now there's some momentum behind the new combined authorities, so people want to make a success of that. National politicians have got no mental capacity to think about anything else apart from Brexit at the moment. And if, like 90% of economists, you think this is going to be quite a blow to the economy when we get to that point, then the only people who are focusing on growing are these combined authorities.
Yeah.
And if we're going to get, you know, if we're going to have a successful path through it all, it's going to come from the cities.
Yeah. Paul?
Sorry.
No. Paul?
So, I mean, it's interesting that the political developments in recent years, which have then shone a light on these sorts of things, which is obviously good news for us because we want better data. But ultimately, I think it's not the measurement for measurement's sake, is it? It's about the measurement to try and better understand what's going on, to try and improve or make policy more effective so that we improve the everyday lives of people who live in different parts of the country. And I think the Brexit stuff is particularly interesting because going back to GDP, sort of within this as well, Andy Haldane tells, who's chief economist, or he is head economist, chief economist at the Bank of England, he makes a point or tells an anecdote about when he was in Newcastle a few years ago and he was talking about GDP growth and said, oh, look, the economy is expanding. And apparently got heckled from the back of the room when somebody shouted, not my GDP, as in to say, you know, well, we're not really sort of feeling the benefit of that. And I think that actually probably goes back to part of the reason why we saw the result from the e-referendum that we did, in that we have seen jobs growth across the country. We have probably seen growth in their economies if measured by GVA or GDP. You know, the economy is larger now than what it was, say, 10 or 15 years ago. But that's because we're only looking at the overall size of the economy. And it goes back to your point, Diane, about, you know, thinking about GDP per head. Or if we look at GVA per worker to try and get a measure of productivity, what we'd see is that while the economy's grown and while there are more jobs in these places, actually the quality of those jobs has been pretty low, which means when we think about the output, the values that are created in that economy, which then has implications in terms of wages, you know, implications in terms of how productive that economy is, there hasn't really been much change on that front, which is why then that then had that sort of shout from the back of the room saying, well, not my GDP, because, you know, that 0.4% growth figure in that quarter or whatever it was, didn't translate into more money in people's pockets. And I think, you know, one of the things I think that's come out of the political turbulence in recent years is that policymakers don't properly understand what's going on across the country. And actually, there is a political imperative to try and understand that, which, you know, hopefully the developments of the ONS and others are trying to push that on. Whether individual politicians actually pick up that mantle, particularly thinking about domestic policy in the next couple of years and not being completely obsessed only by Brexit, which of course is very important, but we've got to have some response to why we see these problems across the country. That's going to be crucial, I think. It's not just the point of producing the data. We've got to be thinking about what does this then mean, and politicians have to then pick up the agenda to say, well, this is how we're going to sort of respond as a result of that.
And I mean, is there a job? Well, is there a job of work to be done around engaging the public more generally on these sorts of conversations and questions? I mean, going by the title of your, you know, not your new position, as it were, public understanding, in the sense of being very deliberately trying, or public policy, but trying to think about how we engage with the external world rather than, you know, policy wonks talking to policy wonks about issues of data and measurement that don't really interest the majority of the public, and sensibly so. I mean, where does the public sit in this? And I suppose partly that, I mean, you're in the media spotlight quite a bit. You know, you write and are, you know, you're a spokesperson in many respects. I'd be interested in your thoughts and reflections on, you know, the role of the media in all of this.
I think the public understanding of it is really important. Or maybe that's the wrong way to put it. It's actually the research's understanding of the public is the way around to think about it.
Yeah.
But that conversation, because economists are very influential in the way we think about policy and in Whitehall and even in the city administrations. And if you're in that position of power, you have to be trusted with it, and that means people understand what you're doing. And you respond to their concerns. There needs to be legitimacy to the role. So I've always spent a lot of my time involved in public engagement in different ways.
Yeah.
many academics don't bother because they don't have any incentives in their promotion and pay to do so, and that's entirely understandable. But enough of us need to do it. And the Brexit vote came as a shock to the economics establishment because, you know, we do 90% think it's a bad economic decision,
yeah.
as well as all the other reasons some people think it's a bad decision.
Yeah.
And yet that message just didn't seem to have any traction, obviously, yeah. in the vote. And I think in a way that's been a bigger shock to economists than the financial crisis.
Yes.
Because we all feel that, you know, this fundamental point that prosperity in the modern world comes from your connections with people and the geography of those really matters. Mm-hmm. That's fundamental to economics. It's Adam Smith's division of labour. It's what we're all about. Mm. Whereas the forecasting, not many economists actually do forecasting, no. even though lots of people think we do.
And yet that is the thing that everybody thinks that yeah. economists do, don't they? Yeah. Forecasting. And then you hear the criticism, which is you couldn't even see the, you know, the recession come in. Why should we listen to you on a whole bunch of other things? I think it's just, it's a continual conversation that I don't think we've cracked really.
Mm.
And, I think it's interesting on the, you know, back to your point on the, you know, GDP, in part it sustains its life and its prominence is because it's a single thing and, you know, the media do use it. I think they use, but I don't think they use it enough in terms of explaining why they're using it or how they're using it.
Well, there's this kind of vicious circle between politicians and the media. You know, if the media tries to talk about something else, they're letting the politicians off the hook. And if the politicians try to talk about something else, it's because they're trying to, you know, bury the bad news.
Yeah.
So they're sort of trapped in this embrace of having to talk about GDP all the time. But people are very interested. People understand intuitively that the statistics aren't telling a good story. Every year I run a Festival of Economics in Bristol. Mm. We sell about 4,000 tickets and people come along to listen to academics and they ask really good questions and the academics learn a lot from it as well.
Yeah.
So more of that conversation, please.
Mm. Yeah. It's interesting how the media, what weight the media put on certain statistics as well. So, you know, it's the first release of GDP gets a lot of coverage, and then there's a revision, and then that gets coverage as almost as if the first release didn't even happen. You have the same figure being released three times as it gets refined, and each time it gets a lot of coverage. And the same happens with purchase and managers indexes, which are effectively interviews of people within business. And then they get presented as, oh, well, you know, this, the manufacturing sector or the services sector grew by whatever in this month, or was expected to grow by whatever in this month. And it's like, really, that was just some people's opinions. We haven't actually measured that. But things like PMI and sort of GDP readouts get a lot of coverage because apparently actually it sells. And I think perhaps there maybe is a little bit of an element there again about what is it that the media present? And as you're saying, Andrew, are they explaining what this means? Mm-hmm. And does it potentially actually tell you what we think it tells us? Certainly from a GDP perspective, you know, it's not capturing everything that we probably want to capture. Again, I think that doesn't mean we throw out the idea of trying to measure the economy. I think it is about trying to capture that wedge that you're talking about, Diane. But it also doesn't capture the element of growth across the country. And what does that then mean? And I think the same applies for the PMI. You know, it gets presented as being sort of hard facts, and we've measured this, and you know, we've counted the beans, and this is what comes out. Where the reality is, it isn't really what it is.
And actually, whether you're a journalist or a civil servant sitting in Whitehall, you don't have time to leave your desk these days.
Mm.
But actually, you can get a really good snapshot of a place from just going there and seeing who's hanging out in the shopping centre, and are the shop fronts dilapidated, and how much traffic is there through the town, and all of those kinds of things give you a really good snapshot.
Yes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. No, quite. It's one of the things that the centre, we mandate that the team and various, you know, go to see a lot of the places that we often read about or do data work on, because you have to see it in order to understand it perfectly. As we bring it to a close down, I just wonder whether you think, you know, your thoughts on, I know, big innovations or big changes that you might envisage over the next foreseeable future, in the next 5 years, I mean, or reflections on, you know, some of the work that you know the ONS are up to, and that, you know, what that might bear fruit. I mean, just anything that you haven't said around that sort of stuff that we be good for our listeners to pick up on?
I think there will be a lot happening. There's the ONS is funding my research centre, the Economic Statistics Centre of Excellence. So there's some kind of really frontline academic research going on there, not only about my digital stuff, but about regional, about nowcasting. So a whole swathe of work there. They've got a data science campus. They're starting to look at things like satellite imagery and big data techniques. So that, and the HMRC data, including that in the conventional statistics. So there will be quite a lot happening. And that's great. You know, the ONS is actually at the forefront of national statistical offices in doing all of this experimental and research work, and really ought to be praised for that. I just worry slightly about how it gets picked up in the cynical politics and media that we have these days. And is it going to get ignored because everything has to be about Brexit? Or is it going to be treated as, well, why haven't they been doing that already? Yeah. You know, so there are some pitfalls, but I think it's going to be very exciting. We'll learn a lot.
Yeah. And your, what's the future for GDP, you know, as a measure and a concept? Do you think it will fade over time to become less important? Or do you think it will, or will it maintain its sort of prominence, but there'll be a healthy support, complementary set of, you know, basket as you envisage? I mean, what do you think the future of GDP is?
I don't know when it's going to happen, because I'm not the kind of economist who makes forecasts.
But not one of the few, no.
At some point in the future, we'll have forgotten what GDP is, and we'll have an entirely different kind of conceptual and statistical framework for thinking about the economy. Because I bet you don't know what they counted in the 1850s.
No, that's true. I don't.
But we've got such a profoundly different economy politically and technologically that the way we look at it in maybe 20 or 50 years' time will be completely different.
Yeah. And Paul, your kind of final thoughts on, you know, innovations or iterations around measuring cities and measuring city performance? I mean, you know, how do you think that might evolve over the next 5 or so years or 10 years?
Well, I'm hopeful it'll get a lot better. I think we have a reasonable handle now. And I think we obviously here at the centre do a lot of work in terms of the data that is available to understand what's going on. But I think the big innovations that the ONS are doing at the moment around administrative data, you know, getting that HMRC data, the tax data in particular, hopefully will really push our understanding of what's going on, give us much better measurement of things. And I think that's not only better measurement of things we currently capture, like wage data, but actually probably better measurement of things we don't really capture at all, which is perhaps wages in different sectors in different across different cities, which until very, very recently we had actually no data at all on. So I'm hopeful that things will get better. I'm very excited about it, but it's certainly not going to happen tomorrow, understandably, because these things, again, are very difficult to do. But one day we may be able to say even more interesting things about different parts of our country.
My guests today have been Paul Swinney and Diane Coyle. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre4Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.